Do they not have an abstract?
Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Greetings again and always. This is Dan Godby, medical editor of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. Thank you for joining us for this summer edition of the JSOM podcast. For this introduction, I will emphasize a few additional articles well worth reading in this summer edition. The article Practical Recommendations for Pre-Hospital Device Selection for Pediatric Pelvic Circumferential Compression Devices is a well-done study that provides information that all of us in the pre-hospital world can use to our best benefit. The article Maladaptive Cognitions in EMS Professionals as a Function of the COVID-19 Pandemic will help expand the knowledge of the pandemic's effects and its important topic to assess the impacts of the emotional and physical toll placed on the healthcare operators moving forward. TCCC updates are always important for everyone, and we again include them in this edition. As always, we at the JSOM are interested in hearing from our readership, particularly those of you in the primary positions, and I would again like to reiterate our mentoring program specifically created to help medics get through the publishing process. A select group of editors are dedicated to concentrate on articles submitted by medics and provide assistance in getting them published. Now, here's Alex and Josh with the podcast.
Well, Josh, here we find ourselves again for another edition, and actually closer than we've ever been in quite some time, but unfortunately still not co-located. But hope you're having a good time out there. I've been doing a ton of reading in my downtime, and lately I have been reading a book called Range that Doc Remley recommended. It's how generalists are succeeding and thriving in a specialized world, which really strikes true in the world of SOF and SOF medicine in particular. They are experts at generalists, and specialists, oftentimes much to their detriment, kind of get heads down in the weeds. And it actually reminds me of another book that made the circuit a while ago, Thinking Fast and Slow. You know, there's that type one thinking, which is kind of reflexive or automatic, and then the type two thinking, which is more thought out and intense decision making. And you know, all of us initially are always type two, but fortunately the benefit that you and I have working in the resuscitation bay in the ICU is a lot of those technical thought processes and critical decision making end up becoming type one thoughts over time. And for our recent patient, my partner and I were managing this patient. And his past experience is mostly doing elective surgery, and he really approached this trauma patient with that type one mindset of, oh, in the past I've done these types of things, and so I'm just going to approach it this way. And you know, for those of us who are generalists who have more of a broad trauma background, especially in austere surgery, it's a very different decision making. And so it was just a really interesting thought process. Have you had any fun experiences with anybody lately?
Yeah, Alex, I don't have any interesting patient encounters. I have been recently reflecting on what it's like to be a teammate or even a team leader on small surgical teams, especially considering that I spent my early enlisted career as a medic with the infantry, which is a very directive, top-down sort of organization. But when it comes to working in small surgical teams, yes, there are team leaders, and sometimes you'll have some lead NCOs. But the team is a much more amorphous and squishy thing when it comes to having it go in one direction. Because sometimes the team leader is the leader, and they make the decisions, they take input, and they do the thing. But there are sometimes when that's not the case. Sometimes the ER doc's the leader, or sometimes the surgeon's the leader, or sometimes the ER nurse is the leader. And sort of what it's like to work within those systems. And that's not to say I figured it out or I have any answers, but that's been what's on my mind recently. So the article I reviewed is The Impact of Special Operations Medics and Corpsmen on Military Medical Student Training, written by Rory Wagner, Rebecca Cole, Jeffrey Thompson, et al. I think it's clear that medicine is an interdisciplinary field, and it relies on many medical professionals, paramedics, nurses, doctors, PAs, NPs, and the like. The researchers, in doing their literature review, determined that there are many benefits to interdisciplinary team training that would lead to better patient care. However, there is no current research on the impact of pre-hospital providers on such training, especially for medical students. The Uniformed Services University has a program that does just that, in that it exposes third-year medical students to soft medical personnel in a field training exercise titled Operation Gunpowder. These researchers wanted to explore the experiences of 35 of these third-year students to try to understand how interacting with soft medical personnel impacted their learning. The authors used a qualitative phenomenological design to study their primary outcome. So, a qualitative phenomenological design, this is a study type used to explore the participants' lived experiences, and specifically the experiences of these medical students attending Operation Gunpowder. The researchers interviewed participants the week prior and immediately after to gain understanding into their perceptions. These conversations were then transcribed and returned to the participants to ensure accuracy. Afterwards, the teams read and coded the transcripts, trying to note the most salient words and phrases. They determined after analysis that two main themes came up repeatedly in their interviews. The first theme was that these medical students realized soft enlisted medical capability, and the second theme, the medical students' future roles as leaders and educators. The rest of the results and methods expands on these two themes, using quotes from interviews to highlight salient points. And you can read through these to sort of understand what they distilled from these interviews. This article is useful in that it codifies anecdotal experience from many medical personnel from working with soft medics and corpsmen. However, the authors, I think, would like to expand the findings of the study outside of the military context, showing that more civilian institutions should take on training that is similar to Operation Gunpowder, where medical students could interact with pre-hospital personnel to gain a better understanding of what they do and how they work. However, the military population is very specific. In the military, medics serve a key role as pre-hospital professionals at the point of injury and often bring back critically wounded casualties to doctors and PAs that they gain a relationship with, being in the same unit, doing the same training exercises, and may see them over and over again during their career. Within a civilian context, this isn't always the case. And then these doctors and PAs who the medics bring these patients back to have an obligation then to go back and train these same medics, regardless of that doctor's specialty, if they're sitting in the brigade or division surgeon's role. This relationship is not the same in the civilian context. And so suggesting you would see similar experiences from a civilian-run program versus a military-run program isn't really supported by the findings of the study. I think that they did demonstrate that this military subset of population with third-year medical students and soft medical personnel is valid and does work, but I don't think it can be generalized outside of the military population. What do you think, Alex?
Yeah, agree. This is a valuable component of experience and training to add to the body of literature that's out there. And it really touches on that important point of special operations medics who are subject matter experts in operational medicine, helping to educate junior experts in clinical medicine about the nuances, difference, and requirements and how they are different from that hospital-based care that so many of us doctors tend to kind of get heads down in. This particular experience, if I remember, is based out of USHU's. And so what I would say, not necessarily a weakness, but something to consider, is that we are capturing a small subset of our uniformed doctors, because it's only those who are going through USHU's that got to experience this. And none of the folks who went through civilian medical schools were incorporated here, or even those who commissioned after they got out of residency, which is why, again, Footstomp, the granddaddy of this, Colonel Donham, started GEMX at what used to be Fort Hood. It's every June, and that incorporates all junior EM physicians and now many, many other specialties across the tri-service, and is a wonderful collaborative model. Really love to get more folks involved with that. If you want an invitation, feel free to reach out to us. As we continue to grow out this enterprise, we are very excited to bring more folks under the circus tent. And this is, again, another shout out that if you have any interest in helping or participating on the podcast, we would love to hear from you. Fortunately, one of our outstanding guest editors from a couple editions ago has graciously volunteered to spearhead the guest editor spot. And so Devin is going to be taking that over and leading from the front for us. All right, Devin, take it away.
All right. Today on the podcast as guest editor, we have Navy SEAL extraordinaire Brenton Jones. Brenton, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on, Devin.
Thank you. Can you tell us a little bit more about your career, where you're going, what you're doing?
Yes, so SO1 Brenton Jones. I joined the Navy in 2015 as a SEAL. After BUDS, I went to SOCOM. Did a couple deployments, and now I'm currently in our tactical medical cell, and I'm helping train our medics and physicians prior to rolling out the door for deployment.
Excellent. Sounds like you're going to have some good insights onto why this paper is relevant for us in our community. So what paper will you be reviewing for us today?
Yes, so the article I will be reviewing is titled Prevalence of Trauma-Induced Hypocalcemia in the Pre-Hospital Setting by Matt Brandt et al.
Excellent. What gap in the literature did Matt Brandt identify?
Yeah, so the authors noted that since the publication of The Lethal Diamond by Ditzel et al. In 2020, there's been a push for calcium administration in the pre-hospital environment, kind of in an attempt to mitigate the cascade of events that transpire with hypocalcemic trauma patients. With that push, they noticed that pre-hospital calcium administration has a severe lack of data and the actual impact of calcium being administered. So their primary goal was to determine the prevalence of ionized hypocalcemia in trauma patients prior to blood administration.
Excellent. And for our listeners out there, could you review what the lethal diamond is?
Yes, so it's coagulopathy, acidosis, hypothermia is the lethal triad, and the lethal diamond expanded it to also include hypocalcemia.
And Brent, what methods do the authors use?
And so the authors conducted a retrospective chart analysis. So they looked at 408 charts from the trauma service registry at a single level one trauma center. They covered a 7-month time span between September of 2021 and April of 2022. Of those 408 charts, the authors excluded 27 patients who received blood prior to arriving at the hospital, 2 patients who were pregnant, 6 patients with incomplete charts, and 3 patients who died within 24 hours of admission to the emergency department, which left them with a sample size of 370 participants. So they identified all of these patients as either class 1 or class 2 trauma patients. And for the primary outcomes, the authors were able to quantify the number of trauma patients who experienced hypocalcemia in the pre-hospital environment by utilizing chart review and the serum blood levels taken either before administration to the hospital or once they arrived to the ED. And for their secondary outcomes, they basically looked at the other variables of the lethal diamond, and they used the same metrics to analyze those.
In the end of everything, what were what was their final conclusion that the authors made?
The author's final conclusion was that the administration of calcium supplement empirically in trauma patients from the pre-hospital environment and prior to blood transfusion specifically is not recommended until further data prove it to be beneficial. Out of the 370 patients, they found that only 51% presented to the hospital hypocalcemic, and of those, only 2, so less than 1% of the total cohort, presented with severe hypocalcemia.
Brent, what secondary outcomes did you find in the paper?
Yeah, so pretty interesting. For the secondary outcomes, they're obviously looking at the other legs of the lethal diamond, and they found that between coagulopathy, acidosis, elevated lactate, and hypothermia, there was anywhere from a 1.5 to a 15% change for patients who were hypocalcemic. Now, this is interesting to note because for the entire cohort, the range was 2.5 to 23%. So it's actually significantly different changes in non-hypocalcemic patients in regards to the other legs of the lethal diamond.
And the overall author's conclusion was?
They do not recommend administration of calcium prior to being administered to the hospital outside of giving blood transfusions.
Overall, in your editorial review, what three strengths do this paper bring?
So they looked at one institution, but I think that's a strength because everything is standardized, and it also mitigates kind of some of the external variables which could impact results, such as differences in normal lab ranges at various hospitals and methods of treatment. I think the sample size was pretty good in comparison to the other papers they referenced. They had five other papers, and they were right on par with some of the bigger ones as far as their population base. And I think that they did a very good job in determining the variables that they wanted to look at. They identified that serum calcium is a very bad way to predict ionized calcium levels, especially in critically ill or injured patients. And so they targeted ionized calcium levels specifically.
And how about weaknesses? Did you see any of those?
Yeah, I got a couple points I think that could be better. So the analysis was limited because of the time frame chosen. So over the winter months, you have a limited number of patients compared to the rest of the year, kind of outside of the holiday season. And then hypothermia affects all the other legs. And because it's during the winter, it's obviously going to be colder. Of the 370 cases, only 10 of them were gunshot wounds. And there was a pretty stark difference between gunshot wound levels of hypocalcemia and the rest of the cohort, with 90% of patients who were GSWs having hypocalcemia and only 51% of the cohort presenting with hypocalcemia. So I think this is important because especially for our population base, GSWs, IED blasts are pretty common. And only 14 patients required blood transfusions after administration to the emergency department out of the entire 370 cases. So they hit their goal of identifying the number of hypocalcemic patients upon arrival to the emergency department. But if only 14 required blood transfusions, it kind of makes me question the level of trauma that the patients actually had sustained.
All excellent insights. Thank you. Do you think the study meets requirements to change our clinical practice?
No, it doesn't meet requirements, at least in the civilian sector, to change clinical practice. And the authors did a really good job of noting that at the end. They said, hey, this is not to change the CPGs. This is simply to get more data, which can hopefully be used to do a, you know, double-blind study in the future that actually gets results. In the special operations community, I think that the biggest note here is that if you're giving blood transfusions, that it is still recommended. The question becomes whether or not you should be giving calcium to a patient who is maybe multi-system trauma, but is not going to require blood transfusions later on down the line.
Brent, thank you very much for putting in the time to do this and giving us your insights.
Yeah, Devin, no problem. I appreciate you having me on.
Return to Duty is a 501c3 nonprofit helping U.S. SOFT members who have spine and back injuries find and receive the highest quality healthcare education and treatment by giving them access to the medical industry's best practices, most recent innovations, and premier healthcare providers. RTD is a network of doctors and nurses all over the country that believe in our mission to help SOFT members get treatment and care and return to the duty that matters most to them. For more information or to donate, please visit www.returntoduty.us.
And our last article for this edition is Risk of Harm in Needle Decompression for Tension Pneumothorax, which I was really excited about because, as we know in medicine, there are no interventions that are without harms. And this particular topic was highlighted several years ago in a Committee of TC3 meeting by Dr. Joe Hannigman, who, those of you who know out there, is just an incredibly smart, insightful, and passionate trauma surgeon who recently retired from military service but continues to be a wonderful resource to our community. The author list on this article is quite extensive and includes some subject matter experts across the spectrum of care, including pre-hospital, hospital providers, partner force, armed forces, and some wonderful folks who are well known to this community. So this appears to be a retrospective two-center study, which is probably going to make it level 4 evidence. And essentially, this author panel was concerned with the TC3 recommended practice change for tension pneumothorax needle decompression, that the change from the second intercostal space to the fifth intercostal space may have the potential to cause a unanticipated cannula of the heart, which would be a total bummer. And so to test their hypothesis that the new longer needles that we're using could be used in the fifth intercostal space and potentially cause damage to the pericardium or potentially even completely cannulate one of the chambers of the heart, they performed a retrospective radiographic study in which two level 1 trauma centers had their trauma registry queried from 2016 to 2021. They had a list of exclusions, which I will refer you to the article to look at. And they wanted to take 100 patients from each institution and then have the surgeons from the facility look at the CT scans from trauma patients and measure the distance from skin to pleura at the second intercostal space and the fifth intercostal space, as well as the distance at that fifth intercostal space, you know, where we put the chest tubes essentially, from skin to pericardium or heart on the CT scan. And then their idea was to compare those distances with the new needle decompression devices that a lot of us are using, the 14 gauge or 10 gauge, 3.25 inch, which for the rest of the world that's sane is the 82.5 millimeter needle catheter unit. Most importantly, when you are looking at their results, you can review the demographics in Table 1 to see if this cohort compares to your population. I would say probably pretty reasonable representation of military age service members, which means it has the potential for external validity. So the median age was 27 years old. The median BMI was 23.8. The cohort was almost 70% male. And then drum roll for their results, the mean chest wall thickness at the second intercostal space, that old place that we used to recommend needle decompression, was 38 millimeters. And then the new recommended location of that fifth intercostal space was 30 millimeters. But most importantly, the distance from the skin to the pericardium at that fifth intercostal space was 66 millimeters, which is, of course, a shorter distance than the 82.5 millimeter catheters that we are currently using. And so in reading directly from their discussion, they said this analysis indicates that there is a risk of cardiac injury when treating a left-sided pneumothorax in a non-obese individual if the new 82.5 millimeter needle is used at the fifth intercostal space at that anterior axillary line that we've been teaching. Going on to quote their manuscript, they say, these data obtained from a random sample of 200 CT scans from an urban trauma centers demonstrated that the median distance from the skin to the heart was 66 millimeters in those with a BMI of 24 and indicates that in the non-obese, 75% of the time, there could be a potential cardiac injury with needle decompression of the left chest with the larger needle. So they go on and do a really nice job of talking about how this could change with your particular procedure or technique, and also the numerous limitations that are reasonable to highlight from this study. As always, we picked this article out because it does a really nice job of scientifically assessing a clinical question that affects the operational environment, especially for our tip-of-the-spear combat medics that are far forward. Of course, no article is perfect, and so in an effort to more robustly scientifically analyze this particular manuscript, let's go through our evidence-based medicine quality assessment checklist, Josh.
So for this paper, we will be looking at the University of Oxford's Center for Evidence-Based Medicine Critical Appraisal of Prognostic Studies. Question 1. Was the defined representative sample of patients assembled at a common, usually early, point in the course of their disease?
I'd give that a conditional yes. In going back to looking at their methods section, they said, at both institutions, patient data was obtained from the trauma registry by a random selection of 100 patients who met inclusion criteria. This manuscript actually doesn't do a great job of telling us when in the patient's trauma assessment that CT scan was obtained, however, that objective radiographic imaging probably isn't going to change tremendously during the course of their hospital admission.
Was patient follow-up sufficiently long and complete?
For that question, yeah, that's an easy yes. There was not much follow-up that needed to be done.
Were the outcome criteria either objective or applied in a blind fashion?
Yeah, that's a hard yes, of course, because when you talk about objective versus subjective, these were just caliper measurements on the CT scans, and that's as objective as you can get.
If subgroups with different prognosis are identified, did adjustment for important prognostic factors take place?
I'm going to give that a not applicable. I would recommend for those who are interested in nerding out like we do, since we've got plenty of free time, if you were to actually pull up under the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine at the University of Oxford, their critical appraisal of prognostic studies, on the very last page, they have two other great questions. The first question was, how precise are the prognostic estimates? And that brings to mind for me the question of what was their sample size calculation and was it appropriate enough to get that 95% power analysis? And in looking through the manuscript, they actually didn't touch on how they calculated their sample size. So that's an ongoing question. And then the second question was, can I apply this valid, important evidence about prognosis to my patient? And again, I think that's why it's so important to look at that table one in all these studies, to look at the demographics for the sample population and ask yourself, does this sample population look, act, feel, smell, taste, whatever, like my sample population? We do a test here in a cohort that looks like the military age combatant population that you would be potentially looking to perform these interventions on? All right, and we are very excited to have one of the lead authors for this manuscript, Dr. Max Braverman, who is a trauma crit care surgeon and has worked hand in hand with Pat Thompson, who unfortunately couldn't join us because, ironically, he is actually over in Africa teaching needle decompression right now as we're recording this, which I find very interesting. But really excited to have you to the show, sir. Thanks so much in advance for your time and insight. And out of curiosity, what was it that you, as this big, illustrious trauma crit care surgeon, got interested in needle decompression out in the field with potentially military medics?
So thank you for having me. This has been a real privilege to work with everyone involved in this project on the military side and the international civilian side. I met Pat Thompson through other initiatives, through THOR, the Trauma Hemostasis and Oxygenation Research Network. And before the 2022 meeting, he had asked me about this issue. So I think the overall concern was that as we transition to a longer needle for needle decompression, which is 8+ centimeters, and we've transitioned from going from the second intercostal space to the fifth intercostal space, there's a concern about the risk of cardiac injury specifically when decompressing on the left side. And actually, ironically, on the civilian side, long before we did this, I actually saw a patient who had pre-hospital needle decompression and the heart was hit, and the patient ended up needing a thoracotomy and a bunch of other procedures only because of this scenario where an epicardial vessel was struck and the patient developed tamponade. So it is something that I have seen, and I don't think the concern is that it necessarily has happened too many times yet. I think the underreporting comes from, number one, the system being not set up to capture rare events. Overall, PI systems are meant to capture the most commonly occurring and preventable phenomenon. I think the purpose of this specifically was really to drill down on the future risk. If we decompress as often as we're decompressing in previous conflicts, and we've now moved the location to a thinner area on the body and moved the needle type to a harpoon of a catheter, which is great when you have to go through a large pectoralis in the second intercostal space. It's not great when you're like me, and when I put my arm up, even at 90 degrees, and had a partner of mine do an echo, it's 4 centimeters from my skin to my pericardium, and the needle is greater than 8 centimeters, I'd be dead. And so the concern was to understand exactly what that risk is in a military-sized population. So I got started with an ask to do a pilot study for this 5 days before a meeting. We appropriately did a pilot study for PI purposes and then got IRB approval and then sought out to do the whole project.
You've already covered a couple of my questions, so that's fantastic. Thanks. And what an interesting way to approach a clinically relevant topic to both civilian pre-hospital as well as military practice based on the new and changing practice patterns. It's really a fascinating way, I think, for some of our non-physician soft medics to approach these research ideas. So piggybacking a little bit on what you just said, we were curious in reading through your methods section for this retrospective study and curious about why you chose the particular method to collect your data, i.e. 2 different sites with 100 participants each and having the surgeon review the radiology imaging.
So those are great questions. The 2-site difference was, number one, I have now relocated from San Antonio to the Northeast. And the patient population size, you know, race, ethnicity is differently distributed at both sites. And even though that wasn't included in the paper, because it really wasn't relevant, we just wanted to make sure that this was somewhat more of a unbiased study than getting 1 site. It really isn't great. It would be better to take 10 centers and do the same thing. When you look at the distribution of the data, it really likely wouldn't make a difference except for, you know, a few percentage points here and there. But 2 sites would give us a broader capture of the American civilian population. We specifically chose 2 reviewers because the surgeon reviewers for radiology films, because we couldn't get radiologists in a timely fashion to review these images. And both of the surgeons that we chose were experienced and capable of performing adequate inter-rater reliability. And so we had them collect their images and then we reviewed the images to make sure that they were collected in a similar fashion, which they were. 100 at each site, you know, it's hard. We tried to use power analysis to determine how many patients you need, but in this group, we weren't really comparing any kind of outcomes. It was epidemiologic. So we just decided that 100 at each site would probably be sufficient. We weren't really looking at statistical significance in terms of chest wall size between males and females, so we didn't choose 100 males and 100 females, but we felt that 100 would be accurate at each site in terms of understanding. The narrow definition of who we included came from the military collaborators who said this is probably the average size of the person who's going to get this procedure. It's not the person who lifts weights 12 trillion times a day and is the biggest, baddest person out there. But it's also not the person who has no body mass. And so it probably is the most accurate interpretation of the average person who is wounded in a large-scale conflict.
Well, that certainly is a deep dive on the method to your madness with this outstanding research. And one of the other questions we had is curious about why you excluded participants with a BMI greater than 30. I think you answered this a little bit, but we're curious if this led to a higher rate of sample rejection in one of your 2 locations, given that your patients sampled in those 2 locations may have different body habituses and therefore any concern for selection bias?
So if we were looking at it from the overall civilian perspective, there's an enormous selection bias. However, we were coning in on a group of people that were sort of related to the size of military personnel, according to my military collaborators. And so that was really the impetus for that. The reason that this is important is because the study is really not applicable to the U.S. civilian population. It is in a sense that the question we asked was, if you did this procedure, needle decompression, with the needle that is recommended, which is an 83 millimeter catheter, at the site that's recommended, what is the incidence if you also took the needle and the catheter, the needle catheter unit, and hubbed it as described, what would be the risk of injuring those patients? You're still probably going to hit the heart in up to 75% of those patients. I think even if your BMI is higher, most people, when they put their arm up, they're just not big in that area. That's the reason why, muscle mass or fat. And if you hub it and you indent the catheter into the skin, you're still going to get the heart. But that's really a theoretical association. We could go back and review large BMI patients. But on the civilian side, it is not necessarily as applicable. Still concerning. The majority of trauma patients are not morbidly obese, even in San Antonio. There are many, but they're not all. And so the risk still remains. And I think the risk is real.
Well, that is, again, a really nuanced thought process for your sample, which is really helpful to hear more about. And then in taking a little bit of a pivot, did you look to see the rate of penetrating injury in your sample population? Because we're curious if there might be a divergence between the civilian trauma that you studied, which is usually blunt injury, versus the military population of interest, which is usually penetrating injury. Kind of wondering about that internal versus external validity.
So in the study, we specifically excluded anyone who had chest injury. And the reason that we did that is because hemothorax, extrapleural hematoma, anything that would cause mediastinal shift is going to skew the measurements in the average person. And one of the concerns of my co-authors and myself is that there's probably an overutilization of needle decompression for simple pneumothorax that doesn't necessarily need to be decompressed, A. B, there's probably a rate which has been defined in the literature. It's the studies are all over the place, but of people that don't have pneumothorax, they get decompressed. And so the question was, in the person who doesn't need decompression, what is the rate of injury? For example, if a patient is tachypneic because of hemorrhagic shock, and you're in the back of an ambulance or helicopter and you can't hear breath sounds, and you presume that they have some form of thoracoabdominal trauma and therefore decompress them on that side, and they don't have a pneumothorax, what is the incidence of hitting the heart? So we excluded people that had penetrating, really, or blunt chest injury. We chose specifically patients with an AIS chest of 0. We did not publish the penetrating versus blunt data. The patients were randomly selected, and actually the mechanism of injury beyond the AIS scoring of the chest to rule out chest injury was blinded. So I don't know the answer, but overall, all comers, the rate of penetrating trauma in San Antonio is at least twice that where it is at my center. And so, and they're probably at 3,000 more patients a year than we are, or 4,000 more patients a year, but the rate of penetrating injury is twice that. So I would say it's probably underrepresented compared to the military population. And at my center in Bethlehem, it's underrepresented compared to that of San Antonio. However, a lot of these patients on the civilian side have blunt trauma, and that's the impetus for their pneumothorax and end up with a needle decompression. So, you know, it is applicable on the civilian side. I think from a measurement standpoint, it's applicable on the military side. Really, the purpose was to say, if we're doing this because we're misinterpreting the findings, what is the risk? That was really the concern, was under resuscitation of hemorrhage and tachypnea from abdominal injury or shock from hemorrhage and resultant pneumothorax when you're sticking an enormous needle in an area that's relatively thin compared to a robust anterior site.
That's absolutely fair. And I was going to ask you and Pat if participating in this research project had changed your practice, but actually, while you and I were chatting, Pat sent me a SMS message, and he asked that we share this with the wider audience. So Pat says, TC3 instructional videos, skill cards, and guidelines are promoting dangerous practice, which is hubbing the needle catheter unit. This is particularly dangerous on the left lateral site. We accept that many, if not all, advanced practitioners do not do this, but if you perform the TC3 skill as demonstrated, it has great risk to the patient. So with that, we really appreciate you and your team's efforts at addressing what seems to be a very clinically relevant, patient-oriented question directed at the actively practicing pre-hospital medic, and really excited to see this piece of well-done research get published and presented at THOR, and we look forward to many more great projects from you and your team in addition to your full-time jobs of taking care of critically ill citizens and soldiers. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
All right, Josh, well, I think we've done it again. We have said many words. We've used precious oxygen, and there is a possibility that we have imparted some wisdom, but hopefully our goal here is to not necessarily say anything insightful, but to get other folks to start asking those hard-hitting questions and really diving into the literature that affects our community from whatever journal that may be. There are many good ones out there. We hope you enjoy the JSON, and we would very, very much ask that you give us some feedback here on the podcast, and preferably some critical feedback, because we value your insight and want to know how we can make this a better product for you, the actively practicing operational medic. And of course, as always, if you would like to become involved here on the podcast, please do reach out as well. podcast@jsomonline.org. Until next time, my friend, I will see you soon.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers, and welcome your feedback and suggestions.